We have 2 minutes? Well, we'll use them now. They're gone. Right. I've appropriated those 2 minutes. I'd like to welcome you back to this second session, the second of three. And in a way, Colin Hazeltine has begun the shift that we had planned from climate change and energy interdependence and sustain in the sense of sustainable security by raising some of the more traditional security issues. But I'm quite certain that he intended that to be a preface, in a sense, to saying there are these very deep issues of climate change and energy security which must be taken into account when considering all of those others. So I think he's given us a very good introduction to that. The first speaker we have today is, in this session, is Dr. Satake Tomohiko. Dr. Satake is now with the National Institute for Defence Studies, but I met him first several years ago when he was undertaking a PhD at the Australian National University, and he has since then become one of Japan's experts on security relationships between Japan and Australia. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce Dr. Satake Tomohiko. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. I'm Tomohiko Satake. I'm working for NIST, National Institute for Defense Studies, which is a kind of think tank for the Defense Ministry of Japan. And as a person who works for Defense Ministry, I'd like to appreciate all Australian participants for your significant support, including dispatching three C-17 transport aircraft, as well as international rescue team for the disaster relief activities after the great Eastern Japan earthquake that happened in March 2011. And my parents actually live in Sendai, and I was very impressed by Australia's prompt support for that disaster. And although I work for Defense Ministry, what I'm going to say has nothing to do with the official viewpoint of NITS or the Ministry of Defense. So in this presentation, I'd like to respond to five questions which Richard actually gave me before. And the first point is a brief review of the elements in the formal and informal security relationship between Japan and Australia. I think there are many roles Japan and Australia can play in order to stabilize regional security environment. But if I am allowed to summarize such roles in one phrase, I'd probably say that the most important task for Japan and Australia is to provide a public good for the region. And what is public good? Unlike a collective good that exclusively benefits a particular group of countries, a public good is something everyone can consume its benefit without diminishing others. So in international relations, peacekeeping and the so-called non-traditional security issues such as counterterrorism, non-proliferation of the WMD, and humanitarian assistance, and also disaster reliefs, can be to some extent recognized as a kind of public good. Because if these problems are successfully addressed, that will not only benefit Japan and Australia, but also other countries in the region as well, including Russia and China. And these are kind of areas in which Japan and Australia have enhanced their cooperation. And as Japan and Australia jointly collaborated during the peacekeeping operation in Cambodia and East Timor, and both countries also joined the disaster relief activities after the Sumatra earthquake in 2004, along with the United States and India. And Australia also provided a significant assistance, for the Great East Japan earthquake, as I said. In March last year, we concluded ACSA, as somebody mentioned, and unfortunately, the Japanese Diet has not ratified ACSA yet, but I hope it will become effective as soon as possible so that Japan and Australia can further enhance their cooperation through international peacekeeping activities and HADR. I also welcome that when Prime Minister Julia Gillard visited Japan after the earthquake, the then Prime Minister Khan, already then Prime Minister Khan, and the Prime Minister Gillard agreed to further enhance cooperation in regional HADR activities between two countries. And I think this kind of cooperation is particularly important at a time when the American power has been relatively declining, and there is a growing call for what is called burden sharing in terms of regional and global order building by regional middle powers. So the second point, the significance of the 2007 Joint Security Declaration and subsequent developments. I think the Joint Security Declaration was definitely significant for both Japan and Australia because it officially made Australia the second important security partner of Japan. And this is, of course, very important because Japan had no security partner except for the United States over the past 60 years since the end of the World War II. And regarding this, let me introduce two skeptic viewpoints against the bilateral cooperation between two countries. The first one, I had the first skeptic opinion when the Trilateral Strategic Dialogue, or TSD, was officially launched in March 2006. And at that time, I was a PhD student, and I remember that when I interviewed one Japanese defense official, he never recognized the importance of the Joint Declaration of Security Cooperation between two countries. And what he said was that, you know, Japan-Australia Security Cooperation was not indeed cooperation, which is kyoryoku, but one of several security exchanges, koryu, that Japan had with other regional countries. And I think this kind of view remains still strong among Japanese defense people, although, you know, they are, of course, decreasing. And I mean, Japanese people tend to underestimate Australia's capacity as a security partner. Another skeptic viewpoint took place from 2007 to 2008 when the new Prime Minister Kevin Rudd came to power. And since he was recognized as a sort of pro-China person, and since he visited China by skipping Japan while his first trip to Asia, some people argued that Japan-Australia bilateral security cooperation lost its momentum. And what is called whaling, you know, conflict between two countries also endorsed such a viewpoint. But if you look at the current status of the security cooperation between Japan and Australia, you will see that these skeptical viewpoints were actually wrong. And both countries have expanded their cooperation through the establishment of the 2+2, the conclusion of ACSA, and global cooperation such as PSI and HADR and so on, which are much more than simple exchanges between two countries. And also the bilateral security cooperation survived or even become enhanced despite a change of government from conservative to more liberal leadership in each country. And I think this demonstrates that security cooperation between two countries has already become a strong and permanent partnership rather than the ad hoc, you know, simple ad hoc coalition between two countries. In other words, leaders in both countries clearly recognize the importance of roles of the bilateral security cooperation, as I said. And third point, as an assessment of the bilateral security relationship within the wider framework of each country's position in the United States alliance system, which is very important because traditionally the U.S. has maintained bilateral alliance relationships, the so-called hub-and-spoke structures with regional allies, including Japan and Australia. Recently, however, the United States has encouraged the spokes-to-spoke relationships, such as Japan-Australia Security Cooperation. And not only Japan and Australia, but also other dyads, such as South Korea and Australia, and Japan and South Korea have also developed similar mechanisms in these years. I think, you know, this is a part of an So I think that Japan-Australia cooperation is a part of this, you know, broader strategy by the United States to shift greater responsibility for regional and global order building to its partners and friends. And I think that the TSD or Japan-Australia Security Cooperation is a part of this broader framework, you know, of the U.S. regional strategy. But what I'd like to emphasize here is that, you know, among a number of regional multilateral approaches, you know, TSD or Japan-Australia Security Cooperation is the most institutionalized and reliable framework. For example, you know, Japan and South Korea have been negotiating enhancing bilateral defense tie, you know, including the conclusion of ACSA or JISOMIA. But the progress is actually very slow, and things have not been easy as we originally expected. Partly because of historical issues, you know, other kind of things. So in that sense, I would say that Japan-Australia Security Cooperation is the most advanced framework in the region and can play a role model, sort of role model for other bilateral or multilateral cooperation in the region. Okay, fourth question. And what are shared or divergent strategic concerns? I think there are many, many strategic concerns, you know, we share. But what I have been concerned most is Japan's what is called inward-looking posture. Because of long-term economic recession, Japan has been shrinking its global commitment during the last decades. For instance, Japan's ODA budget is almost half of its peak in 2001. And although the government recently announced to dispatch PKOs to South Sudan, the total number of Japan's contribution to UN PKOs is not so big, especially compared with other regional countries such as South Korea and China. Also, you know, the so-called triple disasters caused by March 11th earthquake, you know, as well as the escalating tension in the region surrounding Japan. These things make Japanese people tend to focus on its domestic issues or national security rather than international security issues. So I think what is important is that the Japanese government should send a strong message to international society that we never reduce our global commitment despite escalating tension in the region surrounding Japan, as well as the huge damages caused by March 11 earthquake. And I think this is also very important thing for Japan's security cooperation. Another important issue is probably the rise of China. And I know some people say that the TSD or Japan's Security Cooperation is nothing but for containment of, or at least, you know, balancing against the rise of China. But I'm telling you that this is neither containment nor the balancing against China. Because, oh, sorry. he said I should speak slowly, so but maybe it's too late, I think. But this might be hedge against the undesirable scenario in the future, but both Japan and Australia welcome the peaceful rise of China. And we must avoid that China understands our cooperation as a sort of containment act, you know, and become more assertive in response to our enhanced cooperation. We must avoid this kind of situation. So what is important is that we must keep reassuring China that we never intend to contain you. You know, but try to encourage them to peacefully integrate into the rule-based international order. That is important things I say. Finally, how do I view Japanese and Australian contributions to global, regional, and national nuclear disarmament and nuclear abolition in relation to their joint and separate security interests? I think this is a very, very important part of our contribution because, as I said, one of our major missions is to provide a public good which can benefit all parties rather than collective good which exclusively benefit the US and its allies. In that sense, contribution to nuclear disarmament and nuclear abolition should be recognized as one of the most important agendas of our security missions. For instance, cooperation in ICNLD, International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, was a typical example in which Japan and Australia fully took advantage of their status as non-nuclear states, non-nuclear powers, and contributed to the creation of international norms of nuclear disarmament. And, you know, I'm working for Defense Ministry, so I have to admit that the U.S. nuclear extended deterrence remains very, very important for both Japan and Australia. You know, especially in the short term. But in the longer term, Japan and Australia can aim at the total abolition of nuclear weapons in the world. You know. And again, this cannot be achieved by nuclear powers such as the US, Russia, and China. That's why, you know, Japan and Australia have a sort of comparative advantage in that sense. And this is a role of both Japan and Australia, I would say, two middle powers in the region to promote and realize the world with a nuclear weapon. Thank you very much.
Dr. Sitake, thank you very much for that very clear and comprehensive account of the security relationship resting in the security declaration. I was personally very interested to hear that skeptic's view of the translation in Japanese. Is it truly kyoryoku or not? I now want to introduce the second speaker in this session. It's Mr. Kawasaki Akira, who is a representative from Peace Boat, a very well-known organization both within Japan and internationally for its creative contributions to the construction of positive peace. But he also has a particular relationship to this issue because he was one of the two NGO advisors to the International Commission for non-proliferation and nuclear disarmament with the chairpersons Gareth Evans and Kawasaki Yoriko. So without further ado, Kawasaki Akira, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard, and thank you for the introduction. I'm going to start from the NGO's evaluation on the ICNND, the Joint Commission by Australia and Japan on Nuclear Disarmament and Non-Proliferation, and try to elaborate from there about Japan and Australia's common agenda towards nuclear abolition. I'd like to say that the experience of the ICNND from a viewpoint as an NGO activist provided two major things to the public debate for nuclear disarmament. One is it helped enhancing the government and civil society cooperation in Japan for nuclear disarmament. And the second is it helped enhance to Japan and Australia partnership in NGOs, at the NGO level, to work on nuclear disarmament. For the part of the government and civil society cooperation in Japan, NGOs in Japan created a network to work with the commission by presenting ideas and submissions. And this network was able to have a regular and high-level meeting and discussion with the foreign ministry on the question of nuclear disarmament, and this asset still continues. And for the part of Japan and Australia, civil society cooperation, I think it is a very new in history that Australian groups and Japanese groups have some common table to discuss and compare the tasks they are facing and try to develop common agenda. And on the Australian side, there was also a network among NGOs to be engaged in the process of ICNND. And when the report of the commission was launched in December 2009, the Australia and Japan NGOs jointly issued a statement and evaluated the report. In short, we NGOs said, while the Commission's report had several useful recommendations, the pace of the action plan for nuclear disarmament laid out in the report was far too slow. For example, the report aimed for nuclear risk minimization point by the year 2025, when there should be fewer than 2,000 nuclear warheads in the world. However, beyond that point, no process or no timetable for moving to zero of nuclear weapons was presented. So there was a kind of criticism about this slow pace from the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and other Hibakusha organizations, the Able Sufferers organization. I understand that the Commission tried to be realistic and focusing on kind of short-term and medium-term actions that policymakers can take. However, without articulating a clear goal of making zero of nuclear weapons, such short-term oriented list of actions can be just used for as an excuse to delaying advancing the goal. However, at the same time, I can identify two major things which are very useful in promoting the goal of nuclear disarmament. One is about the limiting of the role of nuclear weapons in their security policies. This is called as sole purpose policy of nuclear doctrine. And the other is about nuclear weapons convention or a multilateral treaty to categorically ban nuclear weapons, just like antipersonal landmines or cluster munitions were categorically banned by international treaty. The Commission did not call for immediate commencement of negotiation for such a nuclear weapons convention. However, it proposed that preparatory work should commence now, immediately, to make a basic ground for such a negotiation can be started in a later stage. So for the part of this limitation on nuclear weapons' role in security policies or the sole purpose policy, it's very important that, because Japan and Australia are the two key major non-nuclear country which is allied to the nuclear weapon states, meaning the US. So if those allied, US-allied countries can take steps towards delegitimizing and minimizing the role of nuclear weapons in their security arrangement, it has a huge impact globally. So the sole purpose doctrine is to just to define that the sole purpose of possessing nuclear weapons is to deter the other's use of nuclear weapons. In other words, it will prohibit any nuclear retaliation to non-nuclear attacks. So by declaring so, it minimizes the role of nuclear weapons. So this Commission report called for such an adoption of such a policy. And especially it asked the US to take the lead in making a nuclear posture review last year. However, US decision on this policy in April 2010 was just stopped one step short of that. It took the same direction, but said that as for now, it cannot go that far. And in response to that, the Australian government declared through foreign minister's announcement as of May 2010, that Australia would be comfortable if such a commitment was expressed by the US. For the part of Japan, there was a kind of complicated process. And I saw there was a huge resistance and reluctance among traditional defense community to go that far of the limitation of the nuclear weapons role. However, due to the active political work by Foreign Minister Katsuya Okada in early 2010, the government made clear that Japan will continue to discuss, positively discuss, on the concept of its sole purpose. And this position was succeeded by his successor, Seiji Maehara, And Sage Maehara declared that Japan would like to deepen that discussion at the meeting, foreign ministers' meeting, that Japan and Australia co-sponsored in September 2010 by having 10 countries group on working on nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation. And this 10 countries group is known as NPDI now, and which is continuing its work. So I hope the two governments can work together to advance the agenda of this further limiting the role of nuclear weapons, including using this 10 countries group. And for the part of the Nuclear Weapons Convention, it was significant that the ICNND recommended the commencement of preparatory work. And again, this 10 countries group has some potential, and Japan and Australia can take some steps there. Just last month, at the United Nations General Assembly First Committee, three countries of Mexico, Norway, and Austria made a very interesting proposal to establish a new framework under the auspices of UN General Assembly to work for nuclear disarmament, because the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva has been unable to function for about 15 years by now. And this Mexico is also a member of this 10 countries group led by Australia and Japan. So I understand that both governments of Australia and Japan has been reluctant to go for the immediate commencement of the negotiation of such a convention. However, the governments can think of some new and flexible modality, perhaps working with Mexico and some others, to create a place of consultation for such a global treaty process can be started. As the 2006 Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, chaired by Hans Blix, noted that so long as any state has nuclear weapons, others will want them. This is a very simple principle that we should bear in mind. So if we really become serious on nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation, the only way to guarantee that is to work for a global ban of such weapons, and Australia and Japan have special responsibility on that as a country of that are allied to the world's largest nuclear weapons state, the USA. Thank you very much.
Kawasaki-san, thank you very much for that very clearly and extremely well-informed account, particularly of the joint commission, which was really a very fine initiative of the two governments. But there are always further issues to discuss. I'd now like to introduce Dr. Michael Hamill-Green, Professor Michael Hamill-Green from Victoria University in the city of Melbourne in Australia. Professor Hamill-Green is one of the world experts on the question of nuclear weapon-free zones, and yesterday some of us were privileged to hear a very detailed and important paper on the expansion of the concept of a Northeast Asia nuclear weapon-free zone, an issue which would be of great help and benefit, in his view, to the security of both Japan and Australia. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Michael Hamill-Green.
Thank you, Richard, for that generous introduction. Japan and Australia have both been strong supporters of nuclear weapon-free zones. These zones are regional groups of states that have signed up to treaties to ban the development, acquisition, stationing, and deployment of nuclear weapons within the zone, and to seek binding security guarantees from the nuclear weapon states not to use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against the zone states. And some 138 out of 193 UN member states are now members of such zones, almost three quarters of the international community. Australia took a lead role in chairing the negotiations that culminated in the 1985 South Pacific Nuclear Free Zone Treaty. And that was only the second such treaty in a populated region after the 1967 Latin American Treaty. Both Japan and Australia have regularly supported resolutions in the UN General Assembly on nuclear weapon-free zone proposals for the Middle East and the whole Southern Hemisphere. And both have attended conferences of parties of all the existing nuclear weapon-free zones. And in addition, Japan played an active role in supporting negotiations for the most recent zone, the 2006 Central Asia Nuclear Weapon-Free Zone Treaty. It hosted two of the treaty drafting conferences at Sapporo in Japan in 1999 and 2000. And in this, Akira mentioned the 10 countries group that Australia and Japan have just convened, and that includes one of its current immediate priorities is to strengthen the expanding global framework of nuclear weapon-free zones. Oddly, however, neither Japan nor Australia has so far sought at a governmental level to pursue the concept of creating a nuclear weapon-free zone in Japan's own region, Northeast Asia. And this is despite the concerns both countries have raised over the proliferation threat on the Korean Peninsula posed by North Korea's withdrawal from the NPT, its 2006 and 2009 nuclear weapons tests, and its current pursuit of enrichment capabilities that will eventually give it the capacity to produce over 100 nuclear warheads. If the proliferation stakes in Northeast Asia are so high, with such serious risks for the whole Asia-Pacific region and the global non-proliferation regime, it seems inconsistent that neither Japan nor Australia at the governmental level have pursued the same regional approach for Northeast Asia that they have so strongly supported elsewhere. That's to say, moving to establish regional nuclear weapon-free zones. This is a little like a doctor being diagnosed with a dangerous disease but declining to undergo the treatment that they recommend and dispense to others. And meanwhile, it's no accident that in another proliferation-prone region, the Middle East, the international community has turned to the concept of a nuclear weapon-free zone as the most promising avenue to a solution, with the United States, Russia, UK and the United Nations about to convene a Middle East nuclear weapon-free zone conference. Finland will be hosting and facilitating that conference either next year or the year after. In Northeast Asia, there has been a government initiative in the past in an all-too-rare 1992 moment when sunshine suddenly broke through the constant fog of inter-Korean distrust and hostility. The two Korean governments agreed on a joint declaration on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Unfortunately, all too soon, that fog closed in again and the joint declaration was never implemented. And further attempts to denuclearize the peninsula through the agreed framework of 1994 to 2001 and then the subsequent 2003-2009 six-party talks were also to fail. Despite their failure, the six-party talks did serve to bring the key regional parties together, and in the absence of the kind of regional organisation that's provided a negotiation forum for other nuclear weapon-free zones, the six-party framework may yet provide a similar negotiation forum, especially since the US, China and Russia would also be required to provide the security guarantees for such a zone. It's significant also that as a member of the six-party talks, the Japanese government did agree to take one small step towards a wider Northeast Asian peace and denuclearization arrangements. The six-party February 2007 agreement not only included a staged plan for denuclearizing the peninsula, but also a commitment to set up a working group on a Northeast Asia peace and security mechanism. Unfortunately, this further glimpse of sunshine also disappeared behind the clouds of accusations and recriminations that marked the last years of the US Bush administration. But even in the current impasse, and despite the deterioration in inter-Korean relations associated with the border conflicts in the last 2 years, there remains every reason for reconsidering the relevance and value of establishing a wider Northeast Asia nuclear weapon-free zone. There's been a number of detailed proposals for such a zone advanced by civil society groups and academics, and the most comprehensive of these is the Japanese peace depot Hiro Obayashi's 3+3 model, which would establish a zone between Japan and the two Koreas, with the United States, China, and Russia being the guarantors and an integral part of that treaty. And I understand this has widespread support, civil society support, both within Japan itself, including parliamentarians and cities in Japan, and also internationally with international NGOs. More recently, the Nautilus Institute has proposed a regional nuclear weapon-free zone initiated by Japan and South Korea, and providing major incentives for North Korea to join at a subsequent date within an agreed time framework. And in addition to meeting the core aspects of any nuclear weapon-free zone, there would have to be a number of specific issues addressed for the Northeast Asian region, and these would include things like the dismantlement of the existing nuclear weapon facilities and research programs, particularly in North Korea, extended deterrence issues that have already been mentioned, the special entry into force mechanisms that would need to be there to include North Korea at a subsequent date, alliance relationships within the region, missile delivery systems, and last but not least, the issues associated with the whole nuclear fuel cycle, and particularly enrichment and reprocessing. The zone would build on the experience of previous nuclear weapon-free zones in other regions to achieve long-term outcomes and offer immediate confidence-building benefits in achieving ways through the present impasse with North Korea. And finally, last but not least, to provide longer-term security benefits in reducing or even preventing potential nuclear rivalry between Japan and either of the two Koreas. A key aspect of the Nautilus proposal is that it would include North Korea within the zone boundaries, but allow for the entry into force mechanisms that would allow North Korea to join later if it wasn't prepared to join immediately. And there's a precedent for this. Two highly nuclear-capable Latin American states, Brazil and Argentina, did not immediately bring the Latin American Treaty into force for their territories, but only did so at a later date. So there would be every inducement for North Korea to bring such a treaty into force at a later date, considering, or particularly in the context of securing binding negative security guarantees on non-use and non-threat of use from the nuclear weapon states, including the United States. The lack of such guarantees was, in fact, one of the fatal weaknesses in the 1992 Joint Declaration. Already established zones in other parts of the Asia-Pacific region, particularly in Southeast Asia and the South Pacific, can provide precedents and lessons for a comparable zone in Northeast Asia. The South Pacific zone goes a little further than other treaties in extending bans on nuclear testing to international waters through its Protocol 3. The Southeast Asian Nuclear Weapon-Free Zone Treaty goes further than any other nuclear weapon-free zone in extending its provisions to continental shelves, and including the prohibition on using nuclear weapons anywhere in the zone. I understand that's causing some particular problems for the United States signing the protocols at this moment. As North Korea moves closer to re-engaging with its regional neighbours following its recent separate talks with the United States, China and Russia, there are opportunities for Australia and Japan to begin pursuing a more comprehensive and effective solution to the regional proliferation in the form of moving towards a Northeast Asia nuclear weapon-free zone treaty. Such moves might begin with Track 2 discussions to discuss the issues and options and progress to more formal discussions either under six-party talk frameworks or through separately convened working groups. For both Australia and Japan, there are a range of shared security benefits in establishing a regional zone. The principal and most obvious long-term security benefit is to avert a dangerous, almost unthinkable nuclear arms race between densely populated regional neighbours still afflicted by unresolved conflicts dating from the Second World War and the Korean War, and frequently engaged in border disputes. Once nuclear weapons were to be acquired by all parties, there would not only be the possibility of intentional, if suicidal, nuclear war, but also the possibility of preemptive, miscalculated, and accidental nuclear attacks. Even without the outbreak of nuclear hostilities, nuclear proliferation across the whole region would have devastating effects on the global non-proliferation regime, potentially leading to the collapse of the NPT, an uncontrolled export of nuclear weapon materials and technologies from North Korea to both state and non-state actors in other parts of the world. As in the case of successful nuclear weapon-free zone negotiations in other regions, the actual process of involving parties in seeking to negotiate a nuclear weapon-free zone can itself be a crucial confidence-building process that enables regional actors to better understand each other's security needs and fears. It's not always necessary that all states bring the treaty into force at the same time. Rather, the treaty can establish a normative framework that allows for confidence-building processes to encourage states to bring the treaty into force at a later date. So to conclude, Australia and Japan and their allies must decide between pursuing a path to war or a path to peace in Northeast Asia. Continued confrontation and military containment strategies have been conspicuously unsuccessful and unproductive in quote-unquote deterring North Korea. Rather, such strategies appear to have merely served to provoke and confirm North Korea in its own nuclear and military belligerence. The peace path would be to pursue diplomatic initiatives based on a comprehensive and multilateral strategy that can provide cooperative solutions to the nuclear, military, economic, energy, environmental, and human security dilemmas confronting this region. So creating a Northeast Asia nuclear weapon-free zone warrants urgent consideration as one such initiative. And there is still time, time and opportunity for Japanese and Australian leaders and their counterparts in Washington, Beijing, Seoul, and Pyongyang to pursue cooperative solutions rather than become locked into escalating military actions and reactions that can only end in catastrophe.
Michael, thank you very much for that very firm and stark conclusion, but well backed up by the study of what is actually happening and what needs to happen on the question of nuclear weapon-free zones in this part of the world. Excuse me for a moment. I have the difficulty of introducing myself since no one else has volunteered to chair this session. So let me just... Is it on? I just switched this? Okay, all right. We should be going there. Let me begin. My topic is the sustainable and unsustainable concepts of security partnership. We use the phrase security community, which in political science has a very particular meaning, and we're using it rather more loosely here. And I am not going to be rigorous in my discussion of sustainable and unsustainable. I think we generally know what we mean. But let me begin with a footnote to the presentations earlier from Paul Sukugawa, Takase Kai, and Peter Hayes. And particularly to say that all of what I'm going to say is in the context of the very deep threats that come to the security of Australia and Japan from non-traditional sources, in particular energy issues, and we could not have had a clearer example of that with Fukushima in a multitude of ways, but particularly in the failure of both national and global governance of nuclear energy issues. An issue which should concern Australia as a major exporter of uranium. If we can't rely on the national regimes for regulation of the countries to which we export, then safeguards policy in the broader sense doesn't work, and clearly global governance of nuclear energy is important. And secondly, on the question of climate change. I have to say on the issue of climate change and security, I'm in a deeply sceptical and pessimistic position. If I can illustrate that just in one example, in the case of Australia, the Australian carbon tax has been mentioned. That will hopefully be succeeded in 2 or 3 years by the implementation of an emissions trading scheme. Both make the assumption that pretty much for the next 2 decades, something like 80% of the credits will be obtained by relying on emissions credits, on emission savings in countries with tropical rainforests such as Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. They'll be paid a lot of money not to cut down their forests. You really don't need to be an expert in the extraordinarily awful politics of forestry and logging in Malaysia, Indonesia, and Papua New Guinea to know that's deeply unviable. The result is almost certainly going to be much, much less achieved than is planned, and in turn, international conflict. One group feels preyed upon, you have transferred your carbon debt to us. The other feels, we gave you billions of dollars and you haven't done what we asked. So security in that broad sense is going to hit Australia and Japan very, very hard on climate and energy issues. Let me move to my topic. Much of what I was going to say has been wonderfully preempted by both Satake-san and Kawasaki-san, and I don't have a great deal to add on those key issues there. But first, let me begin by... would help if I had the right place in my notes, wouldn't it? By talking about some of the positives, in particular the positives of the relationship, certainly in terms of security cooperation, certainly following the 2006 declaration, which brought together a multitude of bilateral agreements, there have been many of the gains that Dr. Satake outlined. There have also been some other less well-known burdens which we need to consider. For example, Japan now has what it calls information-gathering satellites in low-Earth orbits, both imaging and synthetic aperture radar, for military purposes primarily. One of the downlink stations is in the city of Perth, in the suburb of Lansdale, a crucial part of Australia's cooperation with Japan, but not publicly very, very well known. And I think the most important part addendum I would make to Dr. Satake's very clear summary is the question, how much do the publics of Japan and Australia know about this very high level of cooperation? And are they aware of the consequences, the implications, positive and negative? And has this been discussed? I can't say much for Japan, I don't know, but certainly in the case of Australia, there has been zero discussion of these matters in the public domain. To move on, the question is now that Japan and Australia are both anxious allies of the United States. They have a number of commonalities about which I'll be very brief. Both countries in the last 15 years, certainly since the end of the Cold War in the Japanese case, certainly since the middle 1990s in the Australian case, are moving to much more, I'm not talking about militarist, but military responses, relying on military responses in the resolution of international conflicts, and hardening, and to a very considerable extent, particularly in Australia's case, growing, and in the Japanese case, raising in sophistication their military capabilities. They have both moved much closer to the United States. If you're an ally of the United States, there's a range of closeness and proximity which can vary of time between country and country. Both have moved very close to the United States. Both have contributed major forces to Iraq. Japan also had some troops in Afghanistan, and of course Australia has a very large number of troops proportionally in Australia. And both have a deepening involvement with US space warfare planning. This is something extremely important for the future and an issue which has a great capacity for destabilization. I'd like to show you very briefly some of the changes. Military bases are an important political topic in Japan. They're not the be-all and end-all of a relationship, but they're the concrete expression of it, most easily seen. And in the case of Australia, just to tell people in Japan what's happening, there have been a succession of ministerial announcements in the joint Australian-US ministerial announcement from 2004. A succession of bases have been turned into joint facilities and then expanded. And the most recent one is, and both Australia and Japan at the bottom there have signed the Space Situational Awareness Partnership, which is essentially an agreement to establish radars in space for space, firstly for space junk, debris that will damage facilities in space, but equally for anti-satellite warfare possibilities. These are big changes. I'll go through, the Pine Gap Joint Defence Facility, a very old facility in Australia, been there for a long time, has expanded very considerably, now has a role in the Afghanistan and formerly Iraq wars. And the bottom left facilities that you can see there are very important for missile defence. They are the downlink for imaging satellites, high Earth orbit imaging satellites. Again, a shared resource with Australia, with Japan. That was the story until 2010. Yesterday, we woke up to the story in the newspapers, first in the United States and then in Australia, the announcement that when President Obama visits Australia this coming week, he will announce a new marine base in the city of Darwin. And that's its current shape. It's currently an Australian Army facility with about 4,000 people attached to it. It will clearly expand very, very quickly. The quote from Mike Green, former American diplomat, many of you will know, makes very clear this is a matter of Okinawa coming to Australia. The situation of the Marines in Okinawa is something I don't need to say much to this audience about. And as Green says, they want to be able to fly helicopters, drop out of planes, shoot at things. You can't do that in Okinawa. Northern Territory seemed like a good place. However, the key point is that there is no more concrete expression of military purpose than a joint base. It's very, very clear there. Before I go on to that, I want to shift gears a little bit from those current events and make the point, as has been made, I think, very clearly by Ambassador Hazeltine before, that the question of China is extremely important to both countries and a very delicate and sensitive one. And what is extraordinary to my mind is the way in which political elites in both countries are showing an extraordinary sensitivity, a kind of hypersensitivity to the rise of China, its very clear emergence as what we would otherwise call a standard great power and behaving like other great powers. In Australia, this has been expressed very clearly in the government white paper issued when Prime Minister Rudd was in power, but also in successive Japanese white papers concerned with China. And in particular, the white paper associated with Mr. Rudd, he was introduced earlier as an expert on China and a China speaker. What the white paper revealed and made very clear was the depth of his own suspicion of China. And it resulted in a proposal about developments of force structure which went far beyond anything that his Liberal Party predecessors had in mind. And I'll just quote something that WikiLeaks gave us as a small gift in terms of American Embassy reporting on a conversation between Mr. Rudd when he was Prime Minister and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. "How do you deal," she said, "toughly? How do you deal toughly with your banker?" Mr. Rudd then, according to the report, described himself as a brutal realist on the issue of China. And he would integrate China effectively into the international community and allow it to develop greater responsibility, all the while also preparing to deploy force if anything goes wrong. Anything? It was an extraordinarily revealing kind of statement, and certainly Australian security practitioners have been bemused by the combination of fairly aggressive language about China and actually fairly incompetent development of doctrine that white paper has. Let me move on then and say that we are clearly, the big issue for all of us is what happens with how do ones we understand, how do we respond to the civilizational scale of the rise of China. China is not yet approaching where it was for most of the last 2,000 years, but there's a pathway there which will undoubtedly be bumpy. For my mind, it's important to have both historical and theoretical understandings of these, and certainly in Japan, Shireishi Takashi's very nice small book, Umi no Takoku, The Empire of the Sea, talks very lucidly about the successive hegemonies in East Asia and Southeast Asia, of which the current American is but one, and therefore we can assume that it will not only pass, but we can look into its the characteristics of that passing. And for those who assume that the rise of a new antagonist must inevitably be result in conflict initiated by the rising power, I'd urge you just to read Steve Chan's very nice book, their China, the US, and Power Critique Theory, Power Transition Theory. But in terms of Australia, and I think this is important possibly to pass on to Japan, there is now a really quite sharp debate on this issue. And I'd just like to introduce the work of one colleague, Hugh White, former Deputy Secretary of Defence, now Professor at the ANU, in a nice study called Power Shift, an Australia Between Washington and Beijing. And I don't know, the diplomats in the room, Australian diplomats in the room and those involved probably have heard many times, Australia's great fear is being forced to choose between its strategic partner, United States, and its economic partner, China. That's a fairly simplistic summary of what's coming. White opens up much deeper issues that I think we need to deal with in Australia, and I think we need to deal with in Japan. And that quote from Hugh White sums it up. We can hardly imagine, he said, what it would be like to live in an Asia that is not led by the United States. All our history and our instincts therefore incline us to push the US to contest China's challenge and maintain the status quo for as long as possible. Yet our interests and our future should incline us to push the other way. You don't need to agree with White about his recommendations, but that deep sense of identity is very, very important. And I think one of the extremely worrying things in Australia is that security planners and a great many political senior political figures find it impossible to imagine what it would be like not to be an enemy of the United States, and remain in the alliance in some way, but to separate ourselves somewhat from the United States. It's almost as if the identity of what it is to be Australian, now in the 60th year of that ANZUS alliance, is the alliance with the United States, as if we can't think beyond that. And I wonder, in Japan, is there some similar kind of difficulty? I should say that Australia's leading commentator in newspapers in foreign affairs has described Professor White as having written the single stupidest strategic doctrine ever prepared in Australian history by someone who once held a position of responsibility in our system. Some people would consider that, quote, a badge of honour. I'll leave that. White raises five alternatives in very broad brush terms, which for us are for Australia, but I think could be asked about Japan as well. And I think it doesn't matter what answer you give to them, but it's the measure of whether we can begin to ask the questions which tells us whether we are in that identity trap. He says, roughly, we can remain allied with America. We can seek another great and powerful friend. Could be China, but unlikely. So, we could opt for armed neutrality, and I'll come back to that. We could build a regional alliance with our Southeast Asian neighbours, very important now, or, he's being facetious, do nothing and hope for the best. He's actually calling that the New Zealand option, which is not fair to New Zealand. We've had intense discussions, shall we say. The armed neutrality point, of course, is a phrase that comes from the Cold War in Australia. The best book written on Australian defence happened to be written by a poet and novelist called Armed Neutrality for Australia in the late Cold War. The question arises, post-Cold War, what does that mean? Of course, it's not so much between two powers, but it is a very important question. I actually don't want to raise the question of what's the right answer to White's question. I think there are other alternatives, but I think the questions are deeply important for Australia and equally for Japan. And if the alliance is to be sustainable, then we need to pursue that. I'd just like to remind you of another kind of answer which came to that question about China earlier in the... I'm sorry. earlier in the history of this alliance from Prime Minister Hosokawa Morihiro back in 1996. He made a speech actually after he left power saying that clearly Japan needed to rebalance between the United States and China. It could not but look in both directions, an error to look in just one. But of course, that last phrase down at the bottom of the slide, in which he very much said, extraordinary statement for a prime minister, there has been no serious dialogue from the Japanese side with America in the past 50 years. I don't want to go on any longer, but I'll just say that the core of my argument is to say that for security to be sustainable, the questions that White is posing, which lay very seriously in how do we adjust to a new order in East Asia, whatever the shape it's going to be, seem to me to be fundamental. And some of the tendencies within the Australia-Japan security partnership and its overweening approach to alliance issues seem to me to preempt some of the possible answers to that question and to lead us down a somewhat less sustainable path. And I think that's a key issue to be debated from now on in both countries together, particularly following in light of the fact that both countries are A, allies of the United States, but B, seem to have extended their reliance on American extended nuclear deterrence. I'll finish there. Thanks very much. That allows me to close that session and then to open the next and final session presentation from Mr. Malcolm Fraser, the former Prime Minister of Australia. Mr. Fraser had, put it mildly, a very distinguished and long career, not only within the Australian political system, but also on the international scene, and was and continues to be a very active participant, and particularly, I guess I would say, a force for a positive developments and creativity in the international scene. He has a particular relationship to Japan because it was under his government in 1976 that Australia and Japan signed the basic treaty for friendship and cooperation, laying the foundations for everything which came after it, economic and cultural and political, and in a sense formalised the reconciliation of the Pacific War history, which sadly to say, one can't say the same about the level of reconciliation which has occurred with other parts of Japan's diplomatic partnerships, and that being a major strategic obstacle. But for Japan, Mr. Fraser's government's initiative is something for which we remain deeply grateful, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Malcolm Fraser.
Thank you for that introduction, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry I missed the earlier part of this discussion, but I was up here for another matter concerning ultimate nuclear disarmament and the steps that ought to be taken to achieve it. I don't think that 1976 treaty, as important as it was by any means the first step in reconciliation between Australia and Japan. A far more significant event occurred quite close to the end of the war in 1956, when Prime Minister Kishi came to Australia for the signing of the Australian-Japanese Trade Treaty. It meant a great deal for Japan, guaranteeing supplies of raw materials. It meant a great deal for Australia, because we were losing markets in Britain that was going to the European Union, and many of the things that we produced were not allowed to sell to the United States, one of our great and powerful friends. A closer strategic relationship between Japan and Australia I support as an objective in its own right. I oppose it, and don't think because I'm an ex-prime minister that I necessarily support policy that has been supported over the last 15 years by any of the governments that we've had over that time. But if that closer relationship comes principally because the United States has been pushing for a closer strategic relationship with Japan and with Australia, and trying, I think unsuccessfully, to develop a relationship with India as a means of containment of China, then I totally and absolutely oppose it. That policy is foolish, it's wrong, and it indicates the thinking, I believe, which is probably a century old and very much out of date and inappropriate in the world in which we live. The Defence White Paper in Australia has been referred to. I suppose I read a number of Defence White Papers over 40 years, and it was by far the worst white paper I'd ever seen produced out of Australia. And it named China in most adverse and unfavourable ways, something which at least earlier authors had had the diplomatic skills to avoid doing in relation to anyone. We found, and this has also been mentioned, that an American base is going to be, a Marine base is going to be established at Darwin. I think this is a mistake, it is wrong, because it will be construed as just one more attempt by the United States to pursue a policy of containment. It will be construed by too many as Australia getting even closer to the United States, and Japan, of course, is regarded very much as a part of this. This is not in Japan's interests. This is not in Australia's interests. There's a view, the journalist who you put up on the board probably supports the Tea Party. His newspaper supports the Tea Party, and you've got the prospects of a Tea Party-supported president winning in the next presidential elections. How closely does Australia or Japan want to be allied to a government that has that kind of connection, a Tea Party with that kind of influence over far too many Republicans? If you look closely at what they write, if you look closely at what they espouse, it is enormously important for all of us that President Obama win. And that's going to be very difficult with the economy in the United States as it is, and with the Eurozone falling apart, difficulties there. The strategic environment is changing dramatically, and not just in military terms. Europe will be facing economic problems not less than 10 years, probably 15 years. The severity of those problems may be diminished if it is possible to cut the weaker economies out of the euro, or alternatively establish a kind of discipline over the eurozone countries, which they've certainly not been able to do up to the present time. But the history of democracy in Greece, Italy and Spain is not all that solid, not all that sound. How long can a democracy survive as a democracy with 20% plus unemployment? That's the reality in Spain. I don't know what unemployment is in Greece, and they probably don't know themselves either. But it will certainly be very high, and it is likely to be, well, it is very high in Italy. And if serious attempts are to be made to pay down the debt of these countries, then unemployment will remain high for a very, very long while. You can't stimulate a country that is already so much in debt that it can't afford to pay the debt it already has. And that is something that those who espouse more stimulus need to be aware of. So the economic influence of Europe, the economic influence of the United States itself which is also faced with a massive debt, which is piled up for decades. The one way of judging an economy is to see what happens to its currency. The United States currency has been continually depreciating. When I first went to Singapore, an Australian dollar was worth 5 Singapore dollars. It's now about parity. When I first came to Japan, I think it was $1 for, that would have been a pound in those days, for 400 yen. And now it's a dollar to about 80 yen. And so countries with an appreciating currency are generally the countries that end up being in a strong position economically. I know Japan has had its problems over recent years, but that fact remains. Most of Japan's debt, as I understand it, is internal and held internally. But you can't divorce the economic issues from the strategic. Japan and China are the largest holders of US treasuries. That puts a limit on whatever the United States can do in relation to both countries, for that matter. If China will push too hard, especially if another few years have gone by, and about 60% of China's demand is now internal, if that goes up to, well, it will be increasing as each year passes. China is moving economically more effectively into Africa and South America than either the United States or any of the countries of Europe. And so her economy will be more diversified, less dependent on the United States. And if one says there's a mutual interest in preserving stability in the American economy, that's certainly true. But China would withstand a major economic collapse in the United States far better than the United States would withstand it. Now, that enormously diminishes the strategic military power, where obviously the United States remains supreme and will do for as far as one can see into the future. But we've seen limits on the use of military power. 600,000 people couldn't win in Vietnam. I don't think you'll know what's going to ultimately happen in Iraq until the last American troop is out. Then we know the real intentions of the Sunnis. Are they going to? Well, we just don't know. And Afghanistan, as every week passes, looks more like Vietnam. We're training the Afghanis. Their army will be able to look after themselves. Our job will be done. That'll be, we can withdraw with honor and with success, knowing that it is not with honor and knowing it is not with success. America has not been good at picking leaders to support. There's a whole litany of leaders who have been dictatorships, brutal. Even in today's world, in prosecuting the war in Afghanistan, it has sought the support and gained the support of old-fashioned Stalinist dictators of the most brutal kind. So military when are people going to learn that you cannot achieve perhaps the most important objectives merely by military means? And the days in which it's possible for a major power to change the nature of a government within a country by military means, I believe history tells us it's failed and it's not going to succeed in the future. There are words used in that Hugh White article. I read it again on the plane up here and I got more annoyed the more I read it. But he talked about primacy. And it also talked as though American involvement in the Western Pacific has always been beneficial. Now, they've done good things. Many of the best things that have happened since the Second World War have happened because of American leadership, American interest, especially through the United Nations, even the International Criminal Court, which they've not ratified, but they've not frustrated its operations. So they have done many good things and provided the lead where Europe could have or others could have, but they just haven't done it. But that doesn't mean to say that everything they've done is good, or everything that they've done in the Western Pacific has been good. I don't think too many people would today say that exercises in Vietnam was successful or that it was wise. It was based about a total misjudgment of the monolithic nature of world communism, when communism was not monolithic. There's a heavy overlay of nationalism, which was not understood at that time. If it had been understood, America's attitude and its policies may have been very much different. But to talk about primacy in the Western Pacific, certainly America has been the supreme military power in this region. But does that have to remain? Isn't cooperation possible? Under George Bush, it wasn't. It was unilateralism, one country determining what ought to be done for the rest of the world. President Obama wants to reinvigorate a multilateral system where things are done cooperatively and in partnership. And that ought to be the sort of objective that Japan and Australia should use their influence to achieve. Hugh White spoke as though there's a question of primacy between India, between China and the United States. And I think it's the wrong term, the wrong concept. And, how would you define it? One definition is that if America is supreme, you do what America wants you to do. Well, that's not really a recipe for success. It's not a recipe for peace. Australia didn't always have governments that just did what America wanted. Not some of you may remember, but 55, 56, the Chinese were shelling Quemoy and Matsu Islands. And you won't see this written in any documents, any cables, but it happened. And people feared a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. Eisenhower moved the Pacific Fleet in or close to the Taiwan Straits. Our Prime Minister let it be known that if there were a war with China over that issue, Australia would stand aside. We would not be part of it because it was not our affair. He also believed that such a war would be totally disastrous and that every effort had to be made to make sure that it never happened. Well, it didn't happen, and the Chinese and Taiwanese are going to resolve this matter themselves, and American interference or power is not needed to achieve that result. And if anyone doubts that, just look at cross-strait traffic, cross-strait investment. The money and the people are saying, we're solving this problem, and we'll wake up one day and I was told quite some time ago by a senior Chinese, look, if Taiwan recognizes it's part of China, which both parts claim to be, they can keep their parliament, they can keep their military, because it'll be part of China's military. And they can keep their police and all the rest, they can keep their system of government and all the rest. But they'll just be part of China and won't have independent, separate representation in countries around the world. But you could guarantee there would be a Taiwan-China desk in every Chinese embassy, and there'd be special arrangements made, more favorable arrangements made in relation to Hong Kong. And that is the way this issue is going to be resolved. So what do we do about America and those who argue that there's an inevitable clash coming because China will want to be number one, America will want to stay number one? If you look at history, a superpower whose power is waning is probably more dangerous than a major power whose power is rising. One becomes desperate not to be pushed aside. It's like, I suppose, the young bull and the old bull. And the young bull in the end of the day wins. But do we have to have talk about primacy? Japan and Australia will be secure when countries of this region feel confident in the relationships between each other, confident that nobody has territorial ambitions, one against the other, and certainly there are steps to be made. There are particular problems of North Korea, and there are some problems of island claims, which maybe could go to an international court at some point. But to talk of primacy and Australia having to choose or Japan having to choose, I think is just mischievous. I think it's wrong-headed. And it's against this background that I believe those Basin Darwin is a disaster and shows that Australian governments and strategic thinkers within the government just don't understand the direction in which the Western Pacific is going, moving quite inevitably. We should work for a cooperative arrangement. If America wants to be part of it, that's fine. If they don't want to be part of it, they've got their own Western Hemisphere. Doesn't matter. That's probably about it.
Mr. Fraser, that was a remarkable speech and exposition based on both long experience but more on long thinking about the situations of our two countries and the relationships in which they have embedded and the prospects of things becoming much, much worse. I'd like to conclude now by asking Professor Inoguchi once again to make closing remarks for this workshop. Thanks very much. Joan, can I just ask how much time we have?
We have
10 minutes.
We have 12 minutes.
No,
I
don't need that much.
Thank you. I think I know that there are vast cleavages within each of the Australia and Japan as to what to do with the following three problems. First, what we call the Hobbesian problem, how to do with the seemingly declining position of the United States in the area of security, what to do with it. Second problem is a problem of Locke, John Locke, but philosophical. That is how to ensure the economic liberalism in economic transactions when China are coming up. China is coming up. This is a TPP kind of things. Third problem is how to solve the problem of Rousseau, again, too philosophical. Basically, how to deal with global commons like energy or climate. This is really fundamental or serious. But how to tackle all these is enormous. We cannot do much. But Australia and Japan are, I think, in my view, in a good position to address to these issues seriously. Because somehow we are endowed with good people. Somehow we know the both positions, varied varieties of position on each issue. Hobbesian issue, Lockean issue, Rousseau-esque issues, very concretely, security, economy, trade and investment, and energy and the climate. But the thing is, I can illustrate just like the Prime Minister illustrates as to the Mr. Tanta illustrates the Australian cleavage in security positions. I can cite the only six figures in terms of the position of Japanese people with regard to the security position. This is a, you have a web-based public opinion poll, Japan and the world, which is a web-based polling mechanism. And then this is available in Japanese, in Japanese, English, and Chinese, and Russian languages. All simultaneously can be translatable. Interesting. And most recently, it says figure is approximate. Basically, options are status quo or in security, like US alliance, etc. Most vaguely interpreted. Second is US alliance, keeping US alliance while being nice to China. Don't interact, many things, complicated things. This is, third is nuclear armed neutrality. And fourth is non-nuclear armed neutrality. And fifth is Asian community, forgetting about Americans and Australians. And then I give you the most recent figures for the last month or something, because it's web-based, it always changes. And then the respondents are basically voluntary, and we don't know who are they, etc. So not terribly reliable, but kind of, in my view, it is very interesting. It almost gives you what Japanese are thinking in terms of the security alliance of with the United States. Now, top is of course status quo. Don't think too much. Retain a status quo. Retain U.S. alliance with something, you know, whatever, a little bit of that. That's 40%, more or less. That's now normal. Average public opinion means status quo. Second is keeping your alliance with the United States and while being very friendly and do a mutually beneficial relationship with China. Well, that's quite reasonable. But this is about 20%. Out of 100%, the kind of policy we pursue, but our government pursues, is about 20%. And then voluntary respondents are quite regarded as reasonably attentive public. The third option is nuclear armed neutrality, registering 13% or something like that. Big, amazingly big, compared to, And the fourth position is non-nuclear armed neutrality. Well, I can understand, you know, if it is non-nuclear, neutrality is not easy to observe. This is about 10%. But together, neutrality is armed neutrality is 23%, sometimes bigger than alliance with the United States. And the fifth position, as Asian community, excluding Americans and Europeans, 10%, peak. Of course, Prime Minister Hatoyama, Prime Minister Hosokawa have the followers with some minorities with these leaks of people. So we don't know. And then, of course, other options, 10%. This picture is something amazing, like Mr. Hugh White is shocking to some Australian people. But distribution, varieties of opinions changes very rapidly, and the range of options has been widened somehow. We don't know how things evolve from now. So we are in a good position in that sense as well, that we know the diversity of views, and then we are capable of thinking, articulating, and then choosing the best option for each country, as well as the region, and then the global. It's not easy. Each of them, not easy. But for Japan, the immediate issue is, of course, security, you know. Okinawa military bases, economic transaction, TPP. When the Prime Minister Noda is wavering or just placating the opposition to PPA, you know, et cetera. We don't know. Global commons, post-Kyoto arrangement, nobody knows what may come up. But these three issues are fundamental problems because right now, the world is one. United Nations now calls the one UN because us is one world, not just United States, little small country called the United States, and then Australia, Japan. That's not the really important issue. Whole world is one. And then issues which we address are fundamentally the same. That is basically, I mean, little sounds philosophical, Hobbesian, Lockean, and Rousseau-esque problems stand in front of us for us to tackle cleverly somehow. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Inoguchi, for that wonderful and passionate summary of the task before us. I kind of sometimes worry about academics, you know, as if the word passion is, they've been surgically removed. Why else do we do the work we do, and if it doesn't matter? And Professor Inoguchi has made it very clear, it matters in a very great deal from all of us, one world through to bilaterals and multilaterals. I'd like to close and wind up this symposium. First, I just want to say that for people in the audience, I'm sure it's been a little frustrating not being able to ask questions. Speakers have been very kind and said they're happy to answer questions. We'll adjourn downstairs to the lobby because this room has to be cleared quite quickly in a moment. But before we move, if I could just reiterate my thanks, first of all, again, particularly to the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Australia-Japan Foundation for making this possible. We received support in from other directions, but that was the first and the most important. I'd also like to thank the Mansfield Foundation, which was not so much a funder, but a generous supporter in a great many logistical ways, not least through the work of Ryan Schaefer, particularly on this day, and I'm very grateful to him. To my Nautilus colleagues, Scott Bruce and David von Hippel, and Peter Hayes, I mentioned before, but in particular to Joan Diamond, the Chief Operating Officer, the person who made all this happen, thank you very, very much. As a victim of her timekeeping skills, I'll pass over that. But I also would like to thank all of the speakers. You've been a remarkable group of people, and I do thank people for sticking to the time limits. I know how difficult that is, but it makes for a better session. So I think without further ado, I'll ask people if you could return the translation devices to the desk outside, and please come to the lobby and talk to the speakers if you would like to do so. Thank you very, very much. Goodbye. Thank you.